Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's broadcast, of St. Andrew's Head, in our weekly appointment with our popular Latin lover, and a musical reflection to mark the beginning of Advent. But first, an in-depth look at Benedict XVI, second encyclical. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Friday, 30th of November, Pope Benedict signed the second encyclical of his pontificate. It was released to the wider public at a press conference in the Vatican that very same day. And by the Latin title of Spe Salvi, which in English means saved in hope, it has been the object of perusal by many theologians since that moment. Among those I asked for a comment is Dominican Father Bruce Williams, Vice Dean of the Faculty of Theology of the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome. As Professor of Moral Theology there, I thought he was well placed to help us better understand this papal document, which he described to me as graceful in its presentation, aesthetically appealing. You could preach this, he added confidently. Somewhat of a compliment then, from one who belongs to the Order of Preachers. At any rate, I'll begin by setting the scene for this conversation I had with Father Bruce. He received me at the Angelicum, as the university where he teaches is most commonly referred to. I walked past a cloister where a man was standing on a stepladder picking oranges, and was shown into a bare little parlour with a view of a palm tree, noticing a single painting on the wall. A beautiful one depicting Jesus preaching to his disciples, and when Father Bruce appeared, announced by the swish of his white Dominican robes, I seemed to have stepped back in time. I hadn't, of course. I was there to speak of a new encyclical. I was made to feel welcome, receiving kindness and attention to my needs. Despite this theologian's daunting gaze, which seemed to mark my every gesture and reaction, I went ahead anyhow and asked my first very generic question, and got an interesting answer, discovering, unbelievably, that this virtue of hope could be considered as neglected. Let's listen. What is the hallmark of this encyclical, do you think?
Well, the very first significant thing I'd like to say that I've noted is the very fact that an encyclical has been published devoted to this subject of hope. John Paul II certainly was a hopeful and confident pope himself, and he's remembered for his very first words as pope, you know, be not afraid. But this is the first time in history, as far as I'm aware, that an entire papal document has been devoted just to this subject. And it's important because, along with many others, it seems to me that the virtue of hope is the single most neglected virtue in Christian spirituality. Even if we speak of the three primary virtues, faith, hope, and love, we certainly say and much about faith, and we hear lots about love. But comparatively little is devoted to that middle member of the triad, and often enough hope gets elided into faith or into love. The fact that the Pope is devoting specific attention to hope as related to, certainly, but also distinguished from faith and distinguished from love, is extremely important.
Before we start speaking about hope, it's strange how the Pope's first encyclical was focused on love.
Yes.
And now this one follows. Is there a plan in that, do you think?
Probably he will give us one on faith sooner or later. I'm rather confident that we'll see that. There are different ways of viewing the order. Charity is the greatest of the three, but in its own way it depends on the previous two, including hope. Both hope and love, understood Christianly, ultimately depend on faith, so we're working backwards, as it were. Faith is the foundational virtue, and then faith flowering in love through the mediation of hope. So the progression from love via hope to faith makes eminent sense.
So let's get back to hope then. Would you say that Pope Benedict characteristically links the pastoral dimension to the cultural dimension?
I wouldn't have put it that way, but I could certainly agree with that statement.
At this point, Father Bruce made an unexpected statement, confessing that while reading the first part of this encyclical, he was tempted to get a trifle impatient. But, he added, that was only because he was looking forward to the more pastoral part to the encyclical.
The first parts were more biblical and theological, and certainly were instructive. There was a good amount of reflection on different biblical texts concerning hope in relation to faith. And then the Pope goes on to some other considerations that have been more or less familiar in the history of theology. He summarizes a lot of what he was saying at number 27. I'd just like to read two sentences, which to me came across as very powerful. And this is what he has been working toward for most of the preceding part. In this sense, it is true that anyone who does not know God, even though he may entertain all kinds of hopes, is ultimately without hope, without the great hope that sustains the whole of life. Man's great true hope, which holds firm in spite of all disappointments, can only be God. God who has loved us and who continues to love us to the end until all is accomplished. Whoever is moved by love begins to perceive what life really is. He begins to perceive the meaning of the word of hope that we encounter in the baptismal rite, "From faith I await eternal life." The true life, which whole and unthreatened in all its fullness, is simply life.
After reading those lines from Pope Benedict's encyclical, Father Bruce explained how theologians have been accustomed to speak of God in two ways.
In one way, what we ultimately and primarily hope for is eternal life, which consists in the face-to-face presence of God and union with God, intimate union with God. And secondly, perhaps even more importantly, what we hope in is the love that God has for us, this God who is all-powerful and also all-merciful. And this is what the Pope has been reflecting on, essentially. We may hope for all kinds of things, but if we don't ultimately place our hope in God, and if what we are hoping for is not ultimately the destiny God has put before us, we are hopeless.
There's a void. There's a total void.
A void. Or it's illusory.
But in Spe Salvi, it seems, Pope Benedict also raised some questions.
One has to do with the practical effect that this reflection on hope has in the way we live. He distinguishes between getting correct information from these words and these words being performative in how we live. Are we informed deeply enough by what God has revealed and by what we profess to believe as the object of our hope, that information performs in us a transformation of attitudes and of behavior and of our whole approach to life?
In other words, it's not just a communication of knowledge, of facts that have an effect on our lives.
That's right. He goes on to explain that while in one sense hope is irreducibly individual, it is I as a person who will be personally fulfilled in the land of the living, in the eternal presence of God, and who am loved in the uniqueness that I am by God. This hope is not individualistic in the sense that we are isolated from one another, and that is just a me and Jesus type of spirituality. The Pope actually at one point concedes that modern Christianity has often reflected too much of that kind of individualistic thinking. He attributes it to the influence of, and maybe to some extent a reaction to, things that have been going on culturally in the world at that time, modern secular trends, philosophical trends, political trends, even socioeconomic factors. He goes from Francis Bacon to Karl Marx and offers an analysis of how this attitude of individualism was generated. And to some extent, Christianity, he feels, was enthralled to that individualism or accommodated itself to it. More recently, theology, as he recognizes, has been recovering the communal dimension of hope. If by hope I am encouraged and energized to strive for beatific union with God, at the same time that I am for God, I have to be for others in God. That is part of what being for God means. And more specifically, the Pope says this means being committed to justice and working justice in the world. And he goes the range of examples from the fathers of the church, Eastern and Western, Maximus the Confessor, his favorite, Augustine, to Vietnamese heroes and martyrs of the 19th century. And there are lessons in the lives of all these figures. Certainly in a very expansive way regarding Augustine, the Pope reflects that it was Augustine's hope that energized and strengthened him to accept the unwanted responsibility of pastoral office and devote himself to promoting and building community among the believers who were in his charge in ways that went against his more introverted temperament. So hope has that energizing and transforming effect on people, if it's authentic hope. At the same time, hope is patient.
At this point, Father Bruce moved on in the reading of the encyclical, reaching the section where the Pope focuses on a decidedly more practical approach to hope, where he talks about cultivating this virtue, practicing it, learning about it.
He speaks, first of all, of prayer, certainly, which is the expression of our hope, and which we learn to be patient and also to purify our desires and also to know ourselves more honestly. Action for justice and patience in suffering, you know, especially suffering which is imposed on us as a result of our action for justice. Suffering can be a school for patience, and likewise of hope. Hope is developed and strengthened in the school of suffering, if it is born well. Especially suffering on behalf of others. It's not suffering for its own sake. There are things that we have to suffer that are simply part of the limitations of physical existence in this world. But it's the suffering that is attached to our efforts for justice and to promote the good of others, you know, that are particularly apt to train us in hope as, you know, we are more and more absorbed into the suffering for others that the Son of God himself undertook.
You've been listening to the first in a series of reflections focusing on Pope Benedict's encyclical Spe Salvi, that's by the Vice Dean of the Faculty of Theology of the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, Professor of Moral Theology, Father Bruce Williams. He'll be back again at this same time on Tuesday, December the 4th. Well, on a lighter note, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who have asked to focus on stories surrounding the figure of St. Andrew. Be sure to watch the change of pace and tone. Well, Foster, today I'd like to speak about one of your favourite popes, Pius II, and the head of St. Andrew.
1453, of course, the Turks took over Constantinople, and Andrew's head, for one reason or another, this is all fable, fairy tales, was preserved in Constantinople. And the Christians, some Christians, had such a veneration for Andrew and his head that they got his head out of Constantinople and ran over to the Adriatic Sea, almost like to Albania today, Kyrgyzstan. And they were determined to bring Andrew's head to Rome.
Christians ran off with St. Andrew's head?
De cucurerum cum Andreae capite, quod servare voluerum, which they wanted to save. Et inde, etiam cupie bant, they were desirous, Romam istud capo de ferre, to bring that head to Rome. Cum hoc audivisset Pius Secundus, totus perturbatus est.
Pius II was upset.
Well, he was so moved. Commotus est.
You said perturbatus?
Perturbatus. He was so...
perturbed.
Well, yeah, overturned or, he was totally distraught. And so he heard that this head was coming from Albania over to, like, Pescara, you know, on a ship. And he got this idea, and it's really incredible because in his autobiography it must fit about 20 pages.
The whole story?
The whole story of this head business. And that's why you have on the Ponte Milvio out there. Why? Because Pius II went out there and had a platform built where he would meet the head of St. Andrew coming down the Via Cassia, you see, which more or less ends at Ponte Milvio today. Yeah. So Pius II decided he would meet the head of Andrew at Ponte Milvio. Well, you can't believe it. You just can't believe the narration. And he went out there and they came down like in a procession carrying this urn or something with the head of Andrew.
You say that in Latin, please.
And he said, urna, urna inclusum gestabant Andreae caput. Quod cum vidisset Pius Secundus cecidit in Genua. He fell on his knees. Et cepit flere, et plorare, and to cry. Et clamare, et quid, he was a Latinist, of course. And he wrote a whole poem about 12 strophes celebrating St. Andrew. He was so moved by this idea that the head, maybe, he thought, the head of the Apostle St. Andrew was coming to Rome. And he was out there for about 3 days. On this platform, and you can almost see, I can see where the square is, where the platform was. And he had speeches, and people had speeches, and he was crying and screaming and falling on his face. And that's how this whole thing started.
Yeah, there's a little chapel just by Ponte Milvio, which houses a beautiful fresco depicting a profile of Pius II in pinks looking at a box containing the rather sombre head of St. Andrew with an X-shaped cross coming out of that. Out of that box over Andrew's head.
Yeah, well, that's kind of nonsense. They say, I found it by chance the other day. The X-shaped Andrew's cross, you know, is from the, from the 4th. Yeah, very late. Has nothing to do with Andrew, but that's how they decided. Even on the facade of St. Peter's up there, you have Andrew with the massive cross. St. Andrew's cross, which they say is really kind of a silly invention of the 11th or 12th century. And he accepted this head, and they sang this hymn, and they marched over to St. Peter's, and that's where it was. And then Paul VI gave the head back to Constantinople. After centuries and ages, 500 years almost. But Pius II was totally taken up. That's why Pius II and his nephew, Pius III, are buried in Sant'Andrea della Valle. Cardinal Andrea della Valle kind of mentioned this, and he was the Cardinal of St. Andrew, and Andrew and Pius, and so he had the two Piuses buried, fixed up there in Sant'Andrea della Valle. But there's a whole story there.
What's the story about the Janiculum, the head of Andrew being stolen and taken up there?
There's a famous thing up there on the Janiculum where I live, because someone did steal the head of Andrew during the term of Pius IX. This is the 1840s. And I don't know what they did. And what do? They go up the street there, you know, along the walls. And they go up to the Janiculum. And they threw the head in the grass. And to this day, if you go up there, there is a little shrine. A little shrine there in marble.
A little shrine in marble. How do you say that?
Sacellum marmorium. Sacellum marmorium. And what do you know? Down below in Latin it's written, this is where the head of Andrew, having been stolen, was found.
But the head of St. Andrew was housed in St. Peter's Basilica before that, no?
Yes, but some people got the thing and ran away and then threw it in the grass. And Pius IX put up a shrine where they found Andrew's head. It's about 3 blocks away from my house.
They ran away and threw Andrew's head in the grass.
Well, excucurerunt, Andreque caput in gramen proiecerunt. Certainly it was, and they wanted to get rid of this thing. What are we going to do with the head of an apostle? It must have dawned on them, and they just threw it away. And that's where it was found, in the grass. And there is a shrine to this day where they found Andrew's head. And the date is Pius IX, 1840 or something.
Desecration, what horrible people. The word desecration, is it a word of Latin origin?
Well, certainly. Sacrum is to, sacrare is to sacrifice or to make sacred. Desacrare is to make unsacred. That's where you get your desecration.
As always, our warmest thanks to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. And finally, I'd like to end on a more reflective and musical note by joining Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who focuses on the first Sunday of Advent.
A generation or two ago, a very unpopular job among seminary students was ringing the bell first thing in the morning to get everyone out of bed. The reason it was unpopular, of course, was that it meant getting up even earlier, so as to be ready on time. At the start of Advent, we hear again and again the call to wake up, to get ready, to prepare ourselves for the day that is dawning. We all know how hard that can be if we're feeling sleepy. But we all know how necessary it is if we have something important to do. What could be more important than being ready to greet our Saviour when he comes? Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Awake, a voice is calling. That's the title of an old German hymn for Advent. The version we just heard was arranged by Michael Praetorius early in the 17th century, but probably more familiar to modern listeners is the arrangement made by J.S. Bach 100 years later. If any of you have worked with church choirs or liturgy planning groups, you'll know how hard it can be to prepare the music Sunday after Sunday for public worship. Imagine what it would be like if you had to compose the music as well. But that's exactly what J.S. Bach did for most of his life. He wrote his cantatas for use during the Sunday liturgy in Weimar and in Leipzig, often producing a new one each week. The cantata he wrote for the last Sunday of November in 1731 was Wachet auf, and he based a lot of the music on the tune we've been listening to. Now, I bet some of you are thinking, yes, it's lovely music, but it doesn't sound much like the tune we heard before. Wait for it. Bach is setting the scene with a beautiful counter-melody, preparing the way for the coming of the tune. Here it is, in long, slow notes, in the voice parts. Listen now to a passage a bit later on, where Bach sets the second verse. Zion hears the watchmen singing. That's the counter melody. Now for the tune. Many people find the spiritual quality of Bach's music a great help with their prayer. It can settle us into a recollected frame of mind. If you get the chance, you may like to listen to a recording of Bach's cantata Wachet auf as part of your Advent devotion. At the heart of it is a dialogue between Christ and the soul. When the heavenly bridegroom comes, he invites the soul to join him at the wedding feast. No eye has ever seen, no ear has ever heard such joy as this.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. Thanks for joining me. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.